Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay.
And me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
I am so excited about this podcast, The Bright Side. You guys are giving people a chance to shine a light on their lives, shine a light on a little advice that they want to share.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
My whole life, I've been told this one story about my family, about how my great-great-grandmother was killed by the mafia back in Sicily. I was never sure if it was true, so I decided to find out. And even though my Uncle Jimmy told me I'd only be making the vendetta worse, I'm going to Sicily anyway. Come to Italy with me to solve this 100-year-old murder mystery. Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
iHeart Podcast Update. This week on your free iHeartRadio app.
Fodor's Guide to Espionage, a 60s-era spy story of the world's first and greatest travel writer, Eugene Fodor, as he jet sets around the globe. Tongue Unbroken Season 2. This podcast explores complex concepts of identity, resilience, erasure, and genocide. Table for Two Season 2. Think of the show as a deconstructed Oscar party in podcast form. Each episode takes place over the romance of a meal and feels like you're seated next to a different guest at that dinner.
Hear these podcasts and more on your free iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
In 2011, a woman named Svetlana died unceremoniously in a nursing home in rural Wisconsin at the age of 85. Her obituary in the New York Times reads like a novel. When I first read it, I was struck by the story of a woman who was born a princess and died a pauper, who grew up godless and then was subsumed by mysticism, a woman who captured the attention of the world and then died in obscurity. It was the most triumphantly tragic obituary I'd ever read. Oh, and her dad was Joseph Stalin, Soviet dictator, murderer of millions. My obituary will say this. Homosexual Jew Dan Katroser spent the entirety of his 20s performing for children as a giant frog in Times Square, while performing for adults as Patti LuPone in drag in back rooms and bars in the East Village, all the while hoping someone would take him seriously as a playwright. He died as he lived, with severe anxiety and mild inflammation. And my dad is not a mustachioed tyrant, but a former attorney and present-day clown.
Do you like my red nose? What do you have there, a tiger? Wow! Oh my gosh, it's a tiger!
On our surfaces, Svetlana and I couldn't be more different. For example, she is dead. But from the moment I read about her, I couldn't get her off my mind. I spent the next few years telling her messy, wild, and weird story obsessively to anyone who would listen. I knew it had to be my next play. So I wrote it. And I really thought I nailed it.
I can't believe this is all starting. I'm like, what the fuck? So, thank you all. You're brilliant already, and I can't wait for us to do the show.
But somewhere along the way, my actress, my Svetlana, told me she didn't understand her character. And then she dropped out of my production. Truth is, she was right. I was so lost in the plot, I had lost Svetlana somewhere inside of it. I needed to be there at the tarmac at JFK Airport when, at 40 years old, Svetlana braved her way over the Iron Curtain and arrived in America as the Cold War's most famous defector.
Hello to everybody. I am very happy to be here.
I needed to know how she got lost in the middle of the desert, in the middle of Arizona, absorbed into a free-laboring fellowship of Frank Lloyd Wright disciples.
I do just have, like, a big question. Was the fellowship a cult?
It's pretty complicated.
I needed to understand why the hell she married a man whose dead wife's name was also Svetlana, as if the name itself implied some sort of Balkan destiny.
I just met my wife 3 weeks ago.
And why, oh why, did Svetlana become wrapped up in the clutches of a Montenegrin mystic who believed the key to immortality was dance? What began as a pang of artistic inspiration has ultimately become my never-ending obsession. We're going to follow Svetlana through her many attempts to start over. But when Joseph Stalin is your dad, can you ever really break free? My name is Dan Katroser, and this is Svetlana Svetlana.
You wake up in the morning, you live your day, and then you do it tomorrow and over again. And over again. And over and over again.
Act 1. The Princess of the Kremlin.
Good evening. On April 21st, the only daughter of Joseph Stalin got off a Swiss airliner at Kennedy Airport, walked up to the cameras and microphones as if she'd been facing them all her life, which she had not, and said,
Hello there, everybody.
I'm very happy to be here.
Look, all I want to do is start here on the tarmac at JFK, because this is a huge moment. Svetlana's father ran the most antagonistic governing body to the U.S. of all time, and now his daughter is defecting to the United States? I'm watching this newsreel from 56 years ago, and the thing that strikes me is that Svetlana is positively giddy. She bounces down the stairs to the microphones like a red rubber ball. Behind her is the Swiss airplane that took her across the Atlantic, and before her is a crowd, electric with excitement, swarming on the tarmac. More people than were here for the Beatles a few years earlier.
It is very difficult to explain in few words why I am here and why I have come.
There are sharpshooters on the buildings. There are diplomats waiting eagerly in the crowd. The whole place is buzzing.
And I hope next week I will be able to meet you at the press conference and I will be able to answer more questions which you will be interested of. Thank you very much.
The problem with starting the story here is that Svetlana's already 40 years old. We can start the story here. I mean, I guess I just did. But we still have to learn about the fires she was forged in. So as much as I want us to hang out with Svetlana at JFK, and don't worry, we'll get there. For now, we have to rewind a bit to the very beginnings of the USSR. Picture it. Russia, 1922. The czars are out, the Bolsheviks are in. Beloved leader Vladimir Lenin dies from a stroke, and Joseph Stalin, a wannabe priest turned Soviet thug, seizes control.
Stalin decrees mass annihilation, deportation to Siberia, uprooting of whole communities. Mass liquidation.
Look, Stalin's not the nicest guy at the bar mitzvah. He was mean to everyone while he was trying to consolidate power, including his own family. But there was one member of his family who Stalin adored above all others. She was his little sparrow, Svetlana. Here's Svetlana talking about her dad in an interview from NET Journal shortly after landing in America.
The same person who was in the same time merciless to his political enemies, he could be the same time rather kind and tender with his favorite child.
Look, we all think we have complicated relationships with our parents, but nothing is going to be like growing up as Joseph Stalin's daughter. I want to imagine it, I really do, but to a certain degree, it's unimaginable.
Hello, hello.
Hi, Dan.
Hi, Rosemary.
Okay, here we are.
Oh my God, I just have to say, those earrings are everything.
Rosemary Sullivan wrote a fabulous biography of Svetlana called Stalin's Daughter. She's everything I'm not. Brilliant, prolific, Canadian. I have a big girl crush on Rosemary.
Is it all right if we dive into the woman of the hour?
Of course.
Let's dive into her. What was Svetlana's childhood like?
The first 6 years, until she was 6 and a half, as she called it, her, you know, her blessed childhood, it took place at the dacha in the summers with the extended family, her grandparents, whom she loved, her aunts and uncles, visiting dignitaries.
Winston Churchill met her. He called her cute. Little girls throughout Russia are named after her. Her picture is in every paper, like Northwest or Oprah's dogs, if Oprah has dogs. She's waited on hand and foot and watches as her father consolidates power at the dinner table. Meanwhile, left and right, people are starving or being imprisoned or being murdered. You see, the Soviets decided that the only way for communism to work was for one person to lead the charge. And so it fell to Stalin to bend 15 different republics and 170 million people to his will. Everyone had to follow the orders, including his wife, Svetlana's mother, Nadia.
Svetlana writes about how much she loved her mother, about how much she yearned for her mother. But was she a maternal presence when she was alive?
When Svetlana was asked about her mother, she said, "The only thing I remember is the smell of her perfume when she said goodnight to me."
One night, after Svetlana had gone to bed, the door to her room crept open. It was her mother sneaking in and spooning her daughter. While the two lay there in a hushed silence, Svetlana remembers her mother tracing a box around her heart and whispering into her little girl's ear, "This box, Svetlana, this is where you keep all your secrets." At a young age, Svetlana learns that truth is a liability and you must keep it close to your chest.
And then her mother committed suicide.
As the story goes, and it's very cinematic, Stalin is throwing a huge party in the Kremlin. People are drinking, music is playing, and even though Nadia is right there, Stalin is flirting with his hairdresser. I know what you're thinking. Stalin needed a hairdresser? Well, mustaches don't just comb themselves. Stalin demands that everyone raise their glasses to toast the Soviet Union. All the glasses fly up to the ceiling, all except for Nadia's. "Hey," he yells across the room to his wife, "raise your glass." She spits back at him, "My name is not Hey." Oh, what a line. Nadia rushes out the door, races to her bedroom, takes a pistol out of her drawer, aims it at the box around her heart, and fires it. Svetlana was always told that her mother died of appendicitis, and she would believe that lie for the next 10 years. Her childhood was marked by secrets and lies and death, all in the name of Stalin. Here's Grace Kennan-Wernicke, who spent a good deal of time with Svetlana when she first came over to the States. We'll learn more about her in the next episode.
Every member of her mother's family was shot. I mean, every single one of them.
Her uncles?
Killed in the purges.
Her aunt?
Tried to eat glass to kill herself.
Her first great love?
Sent to the gulag.
You know, when I was 16, I was so upset because for my birthday, my parents gave me the same audio cassette tape of Terry Gross interviews that they had given me the year before. For Svetlana, 16 was marked by her father sending her boyfriend to the gulag, her oldest brother being captured in a German concentration camp, and rather than trade for his release, Stalin let him be executed. And then finding out in a contraband copy of Life magazine that her mother didn't die of appendicitis, but died by suicide. So what I'm saying is, we both suffered. Her father lied to her. Everyone lied to her.
So when she found out that her mother committed suicide and she blamed her father, then it must have been a kind of rebellion that lodged in her, pursuit of freedom.
But it's a quiet rebellion. It has to be. She tries standing up to her father on behalf of friends and family who are imprisoned, but he belittles her, calls her a fool, and she soon stops trying to intervene. So, instead, she throws herself into the world of books. Reading about other places, other stories, other lives was the only escape she had. When Svetlana's 17, she goes to the university to study history and falls for a Jewish academic, hoping this man will take her away from Kremlin life. They get married, but Stalin refuses to meet him on the grounds that he's Jewish. So, after 3 years of that marriage, she divorces the Jew and marries the son of Stalin's right-hand man. I could spend hours on these two marriages alone, but the thing that's interesting here is that in the first marriage, Svetlana tries to subvert her father, and then, in the second, she gives in to him. By her own account, she becomes passive and vulnerable, shy and soft-spoken, and her father's dictatorial grip grows ever more deadly. And then, it's 1953, and Stalin has a stroke.
You've seen the film, The Death of Stalin.
Yeah.
Svetlana is here!
I'm here! I'm over here!
Svetlana!
When Svetlana gets word, she storms into her father's bedroom to discover his maid and Politburo standing over him, debating about what to do.
Svetlana!
Shit, the race has started. All right, we need to start putting together a plan.
They're all either too afraid to call for help or too hopeful that he'll finally kick the bucket and they can seize control. No one does anything. And just like in that group of friends where everyone's hungry, yet no one wants to decide where to eat, it ends in death.
Stalin's dead.
No.
The
Stalin? Our Stalin?
Now, with her father gone, there's hope that Svetlana will finally be free to do what she likes. To live inside of literature, hang out with her academic friends, be out of the public eye, and be free. And even with the KGB still lurking around every corner, Svetlana does in fact do three subversive things. She's baptized as a Christian. She changes her last name from the paternal Stalina to her mother's last name.
And how do you pronounce her last name? I think is an interesting question for me.
Yeah. I try to avoid it.
Yeah.
Svetlana Aleluyaeva.
Here's Svetlana talking about the name change.
I changed it because I didn't want my son to be Joseph Stalin II.
And the other thing that she does, and this is a big one, is that she writes a memoir of her life growing up with Stalin as her father. Now, at this point, Svetlana doesn't intend to publish the book. She writes it, as the Soviets would say, for the drawer, because truth is still a liability. The currency of Russia is still betrayal. So she has to be very careful. But the memoir, which she writes as a series of vignettes, calling it 20 Letters to a Friend, flies out of her in a couple of weeks. It must have been thoroughly cathartic. As a playwright and screenwriter who often puts writers in his work, I am well aware that the least dramatic thing you can show is someone writing, because I know from the outside all it is someone sitting at the keys pressing buttons. But man, I wish I was there in her apartment when she was writing her book.
It's quiet here. Moscow. Breathing fire like a human volcano with its smoldering lava of passion.
I wish I could see her press her fingers to the keys.
Moscow seethes and bubbles and gasps for air.
Listen to the ding of the typewriter as she reaches the edge of the page.
I have no great deeds to my credit. I've never been an actor on center stage. All my life was spent behind
the smell of fresh ink, the feel of thick paper, the taste of burnt coffee or tea that probably got old and stale as the days wore on into nights. To watch the suppressed history fly out of her fingertips onto the page, that would have been something. Svetlana shares the manuscript with a friend, a literary critic, who encourages her to publish abroad. But Svetlana refuses. She's not ready yet. Who knows what danger that would bring? It was this very same friend, the literary critic, who'd offered to read her poem at a party. He'd studied the thatched lines on her hand, looked up into her eyes, and proclaimed, "The second half of your life will be far more interesting than the first." This, after the break.
iHeart iHeart Podcast Update. This week on your free iHeartRadio app.
Fodor's Guide to Espionage, a 60s-era spy story of the world's first and greatest travel writer, Eugene Fodor, as he jet sets around the globe. Tongue Unbroken Season 2. This podcast explores complex concepts of identity, resilience, erasure, and genocide. Table for Two Season 2. Think of the show as a deconstructed Oscar party in podcast form. Each episode takes place over the romance of a meal and feels like you're seated next to a different guest at that dinner. Hear these podcasts and more on your free iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Who hasn't heard names like Achilles or Odysseus, Cassandra, Medusa? But how much do you know about them from the ancient world? Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the podcast bringing the ancient sources to life. Greek myth and history is timeless, and unless you've been living under a rock, you have seen just how true that is today. But there is so much more to these characters and stories than what pop culture can do justice. I'm Liv Albert, the host of Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, and every week I bring you stories from the ancient world, both mythological and historical, to breathe new life into these thousands of years old stories. I'm also regularly joined by some of the most brilliant names in the field of archaeology and ancient history, authors of your favorite retellings from today, and everyone in between. Join me as I dive into the wild world of the ancient Greeks and their stories. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Hannah Storm, and my podcast, NBA DNA with Hannah Storm, digs deep into the history of professional basketball, along with my own as one of the first female sportscasters.
Now let's get you up to speed on what else happened around the NBA today.
We talked to all sorts of people I interacted with, from Dr. J to Charles Barkley, and recap iconic moments.
Yes, he's got it. Here he comes. Ray rock the baby to sleep and slam dunk.
As well as some of the wild stories behind the scenes.
We were like, what? What are we in for? The scoreboard crashes before we even tip a game off.
Today, the NBA is a global sports and entertainment giant. Players are multimillionaires and cultural icons.
Iguodala to Curry, back to Iguodala, up for the layup. Oh, blocked by James. LeBron James.
And these stories are about how we got here, both on and off the court. And what's next? Listen to NBA DNA with Hannah Storm on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Act 2, A Whole New World. I'm not a particularly brave person, but I've been told that bravery is like a muscle. You have to work it out in small ways so that you can lift the big dumbbells of valor at the weightlifting contest on the beach of morality. So Svetlana is working out. She finds her voice in her writing. She starts speaking out publicly against the government, and she's reading previously banned books about the terror of Stalin. When she goes to the hospital to get her tonsils removed, she brings with her a biography of Gandhi. And as if it were destiny, while recuperating from surgery, her eyes flit up from her book and land on a most unusual type for a Soviet hospital, a kind-hearted older Indian man wearing a beret on his head with tampons stuffed in his nose. He either had polyps removed from his nostrils or his mother never showed him where his vagina was.
Most of the men she fell in love with were men of quality, I have to say. Singh sounds like quite a wonderful man.
After a day of the two of them making eyes at one another, they started up a conversation. They spoke of Gandhi, of Nehru, of politics, of literature spanning Russia and India and the great world beyond. When she finally revealed to him who her father was, he merely shrugged his shoulders and said, "Oh." Brijesh Singh didn't care about Svetlana's dad. He only cared about Svetlana. Her father had been dead for nearly a decade. She was 36 years old, thrice divorced with two teenage children, and now Svetlana Aluyeva was in love. And it's in love where Svetlana's bravery is tested.
She asked permission to marry him. She was refused.
After a failed attempt at liberalism following Stalin's death, Russia is closing back up again. And Svetlana is feeling it, pleading with heads of state to recognize her marriage to an Indian Hindu. After many refusals, she decides, fuck it, I'm calling him my husband no matter what they say. And then there's the issue of her book. The written word is under attack, and Svetlana still has a manuscript all about the intimacies and horrors of life under Stalin's rule.
I felt, with the help of my husband, Rajesh Singh, we felt both that it would be better to send the book abroad.
With her permission, Brajesh gives a copy of the manuscript to an ambassador buddy of his living in India. Remember this. It will become important. And then Brajesh becomes ill again.
She wanted to go back with him to India because he was ill, and she thought maybe the Indian climate would be easier on him. She was refused permission to go with him. He didn't want to go without her, and eventually he died.
Svetlana had only seen one death before, her father's, angry, tormented, suffocating for days, a fist in the air. But Brajesh knew he was declining. Early one morning in October of 1966, he called her. Sveta, he said, using his pet name for her. Sveta in Sanskrit means light. Sveta, I'm going to die today. And by 7 a.m., Brajesh Singh was gone.
I was attached to him. I loved him. I respected him. And when he has finally died, I felt that I have myself completely changed.
2 years ago, Svetlana had politely asked the government to marry Brajesh. Denied. 1 year ago, she begged to journey with him to India. Denied. And now, with nothing left of this man but an urn filled with his ashes, she has a fire under her ass.
The next day, virtually, she went to the Kremlin and asked if she could take his ashes to India. He wanted them spread on the Ganges, and she was given permission to go.
Toot toot, all aboard. Pack your bags, grab your dead lover's ashes, kiss your two teenagers goodbye. We're going to India. Svetlana is 40 years old, and this is the first time that she is ever leaving Soviet soil. There's going to be a lot of planes and countries in the next 6 months of Svetlana's life, but she doesn't know that yet. For now, she's leaving Russia behind for a short stay of a few weeks. It's just her, a few bags, and her handler, Mrs. Kasarova. Now, a short aside about Mrs. Kasarova. I love Mrs. Kasarova. Where Svetlana was excited about this adventure, this breath of freedom, by all accounts, it seems that Mrs. Kasarova was devastated to be leaving Russia. She cried a lot and told Svetlana not to go into the glittering, colorful, bustling metropolis that was Delhi. It's dirty, Mrs. Kasarova said. And then she probably cried a lot. Because who wouldn't miss Soviet Russia? Svetlana, baby! She loved Delhi. She loved being immersed in the bazaars and the spices and the saris. And Delhi in the 1960s, at least among the ruling class, was terribly modern. She writes,
around me, I saw a variety of different eras, countries, influences.
Svetlana was floored to see the televisions and record players, modern music, modern literature.
Dr. Zhivago, The Sound of Music.
But the Soviets were being fucking annoying. They forced Svetlana to stay in a hotel room without its own telephone. And for 2 weeks, they told Svetlana that she couldn't actually go to Brajesh's hometown for some political reason. How many ways could the Soviets push her around?
The way I was treated in India by the Soviet embassy and by the Soviet officials, it made me feel exactly that I am not a human being at all. I am just a piece of state property.
Finally, after what seems to be some pretty intense pouting, Svetlana is taken to Brajesh's village of Kalankankar by the Ganges River. So imagine it. Svetlana Aleluyeva, standing on a terrace in a white sari, looking down below as a group of solemn men carry an urn into a boat and row slowly through lilies and lotuses in the middle of the Ganges River. The procession of mourners in white, the young boys weaving their way through the crowd on the shore, the boat docking in the middle of the water, the ashes of her husband being poured into the Ganges, his soul returning to the home of his ancestors. In Delhi, Svetlana is taken to the modern, vibrant new world. And in Brajesh's village, she's taken to the ancient spiritual past. And suddenly, Russia felt like neither. Here's Grace Kennan Wernicke again.
She wanted to stay longer in India. And there were two KGB people there that were supposed to be kind of looking, making sure she didn't get into any trouble. But she went to visit her lover's brother.
Svetlana loves Singh's family. They talk deep into the night. They drink tea on the terrace. She bathes in the Ganges each morning. She loves the humid weather and the trees and fruits, and she never wants to go back to Russia.
If I come back to Moscow, I'll return back as a completed enemy of the government, of the state, of way of life, of ideology. And I didn't want to return that way because it would be then horrible life for my children. And I knew it wouldn't be possible to protest. So I preferred not to come back.
But how could she survive elsewhere? She had no money, she never left the country, and even if she could get out, what other country would want to be at the center of a major diplomatic controversy? She needs some leverage for the world outside to take her seriously. And that's where her manuscript came in. 20 Letters to a Friend, the story of Stalin as told by his daughter. But Svetlana would never have carried that book in her bags. Now, remember when Brajesh sent a copy of Svetlana's manuscript to a buddy of his before he died? Well, lucky for Svetlana, that buddy happens to be in India, and he has her book, and he gives it to her. So she's back in Delhi, she has her book, and here's where it gets good. A few days before Svetlana is supposed to go back to Moscow, it happens to be International Women's Day. And there's a big party being held at the Russian embassy in Delhi. Anyone who's anyone will be there. All the handlers and the diplomats and KGB officers. It's fabulous. Who would notice if Svetlana was running late or that she didn't show up at all? It's nighttime. Everyone is getting dressed up, making their way to the embassy. And Svetlana, in her hotel room without a phone, is laying out her luggage. She has an idea. She'll put all her belongings on her bed. Tinkling bracelets for her daughter, gold embroidered slippers and a hookah for her son, but actually, she packs two other bags, one with some clothes, the other a small red valise that holds her book. And as the Russian men and women, diplomats and ambassadors all scurry to and fro, Svetlana finds a telephone in the lobby and rings for a taxi. She waits outside the hotel. Her heart pounding as Russians pass by her, en route to the party. Do they know? Can they see in her eyes what she's plotting? When the taxi finally picks her up and she asks to be taken to the American embassy, the driver nods. It's a straight shot, but he seems to know that something's up and takes only back roads. Until they land at the brutalist white structure. Svetlana marches up to the Marine standing guard and tells him that she is Svetlana Aleluyeva. She is Joseph Stalin's daughter, and she would like to defect to the United States of America. More after the break.
iHeart Podcast Update. This week on your free iHeartRadio app. Fodor's Guide to Espionage, a 60s-era spy story of the world's first and greatest travel writer, Eugene Fodor, as he jet sets around the globe. Tongue Unbroken, Season 2. This podcast explores complex concepts of identity, resilience, erasure, and genocide. Table for Two, Season 2. Think of the show as a deconstructed Oscar party in podcast form. Each episode takes place over the romance of a meal and feels like you're seated next to a different guest at that dinner. Hear these podcasts and more on your free iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Danielle Moody here, host of the Woke AF Daily podcast. We've been with iHeart's Outspoken Network for a year, and what a year it has been. Every weekday, I navigate our rapidly changing world alongside our series of fabulous expert guests. As we head deeper into 2024 and yet another life-changing election cycle, Woke AF Daily is here to keep you sane and woke. Woke not just to the latest headlines, but also to the collective power we all have. Woke to the need to build community with those around us. Woke to how to avoid burnout, and woke to the ways we can all find joy in the madness. Make Woke AF Daily with Danielle Moody your podcast destination for 2024 election news and analysis. And tune in to hear the ways I am working to stay grounded amidst it all. Listen to Woke AF Daily Season 5 on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Hannah Storm, and my podcast, NBA DNA with Hannah Storm, digs deep into the history of professional basketball, along with my own as one of the first female sportscasters.
Now let's get you up to speed on what else happened around the NBA today.
We talked to all sorts of people I interacted with, from Dr. J to Charles Barkley, and recap iconic moments.
Yes, he's got it. Here he comes. Ray rock the baby to sleep and slam dunk.
As well as some of the wild stories behind the scenes.
We were like, what? What are we in for? The scoreboard crashes before we even tip a game off.
Today, the NBA is a global sports and entertainment giant. Players are multimillionaires and cultural icons.
Iguodala to Curry, back to Iguodala, up for the layup. Oh, blocked by James! LeBron James!
And these stories are about how we got here, both on and off the court. And what's next? Listen to NBA DNA with Hannah Storm on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Act 3, Coming to America.
Were you involved in the rerouting of Stalin's daughter?
I'm very much involved.
You want to tell me about that?
Yeah. It's a really funny story.
Chester Bowles was the ambassador to India for much of the 1960s. So he was the guy to talk to if, say, you were Stalin's daughter and you were trying to defect to the U.S. from Delhi in 1967.
I was in bed with a case, a short, very brief case of flu. And the office called and said they want to come to see me, Tom. They came in at 7 o'clock and said that a person describing herself as Stalin's daughter just arrived at the embassy with a Russian passport in good order. And what should we do about it?
We should get up out of bed.
The first thing I did is say, I don't think Stalin has a daughter.
Here's Rosemary again.
First, they think she's probably mentally imbalanced. They don't really believe her, but she's carrying this book, this manuscript, which is 20 letters to a friend. So they take it. They assess it, and it's too authentic not to be real. And so they say, well, we're not sure we can take her in, but we've got to get her out of India, because if she's found here, the consequences to her in the Soviet Union may be severe.
So Bowles is concerned. He doesn't think Svetlana has thought this through. He asks her,
are you really sure that you want to leave home? You've got a daughter and a son there, and this is a terribly big step to take. Have you really thought through? And you could go back to the Russian embassy right now. And she immediately said, if you force me to do that, I interrupted her. I said, well, we're not forcing you to do anything. Mm. She said, well, if this is your decision, I will go to the press tonight.
I love this. This is a very different Svetlana than we've seen, ready and willing to risk it all. The other night, I was in bed with my husband, Jordan, and it was late. He was drifting off to sleep, and I was chattering about something, probably myself, because I find myself endlessly fascinating. Anyway, I started to get excited, which means that I was getting loud, at which point Jordan said, ow. What? I asked. My foot. You're so loud, it's making my foot hurt. I tell this to you because I know that this is a podcast, and I know that you're probably listening to this with earbuds in your ears. I know that I have producers and sound engineers who will help modulate my volume, but still, the next part of the story is ridiculous, and I'm going to get excited, which means I'm going to get loud. So if you're Jordan, hold on to your feet, baby, because Dan is going to scream. Svetlana and her CIA escort go to Rome, from which they will fly directly to the U.S., but No sooner do they arrive in the Eternal City than word arrives that the U.S. will not take Svetlana. They're too deep into arms discussions with the Russians. Taking Stalin's defecting daughter is too much of a liability. Worse still, the Italian government has freaked the fuck out. Svetlana cannot be in Rome. Insert the following ridiculous international diplomatic technicalities. Svetlana has landed in the international wing of the airport, which is technically not Rome, even though it's in Rome, from which she was picked up and taken directly to an international apartment complex, which is also technically not Rome, even though it's in Rome. So now she's locked in an apartment and waiting on the US to figure out what to do next, knowing every hour is another hour for the Russians to figure out she's gone, but not in Rome. But the U.S. is still dragging their feet, so it's up to the impartial Swiss to take Svetlana because word is moving fast. A New York Times reporter in Delhi figured out what happened, and now articles are emerging that Svetlana defected. Worse, it's coming to light that she is in Rome, but not in Rome because remember, technically she's not in Rome, even though she is very much in Rome. When in Rome, as they say. I still don't know what that means. So, the heat is turned up, and now Svetlana and her escort have a flight to Switzerland. They hop in a car and race to the airport where they are met by, in my humble and unbiased homosexual opinion, the most important contribution the Italians have given to modern society, the paparazzi. It's chaos. Svetlana's escort slips out, but Svetlana stays in the car, which circles around the airport until it finds an abandoned spot, a loading dock for luggage, and drops Svetlana off like a piece of Russian baggage. The idea? Svetlana will be smuggled onto the plane with the rest of the suitcases. Hashtag brilliant, hashtag life goals, hashtag Russian luggage. So, Stalin's daughter is on a truck with a bunch of bags cruising through the airport when Italian officials race towards it screaming, "She can't come this way! There are reporters everywhere!" So Svetlana is yanked off the bags and then put in a stairwell where she remains for several hours. Hashtag stairwell, hashtag blessed, hashtag what happened to Svetlana's escort? Her escort is on the plane, but it's been so long he's worried, thinking that Svetlana has been arrested. He gets off the plane and searches the airport, finally finding her. But the two have missed their flight. Defeated, they go back to the international apartment just the way they came. Except for one thing. Svetlana's red suitcase with the manuscript. That was the only thing that made it onto the plane to Geneva. So Svetlana is still in Rome, but not in Rome, and the Italians are still pissed. They forced the Americans to pay for a private plane for Svetlana and her escort to Geneva. And finally, the United States of America plays ball. Svetlana makes it to Geneva, where she is reunited with her book. She stays in this new Swiss purgatory for a few weeks until an agreement is hatched with a U.S. State Department official named George Kennan, the publisher Harper & Row, and a translator named Priscilla Johnson McMillan. We'll learn about these folks in the next episode. But for now, Svetlana has got herself a six-month visa and a book deal for $1.5 million, which would be roughly $13 million today. According to the internet, that's more than the net worth of Tanya Harding and Nancy Kerrigan combined. And so, on April 21st, 1967, Svetlana Aleluyeva, Joseph Stalin's daughter, exhausted and exhilarated, flies in an airplane across the Atlantic Ocean from Switzerland to New York City, landing at a tarmac at John F. Kennedy Airport to throngs of reporters, photographers, diplomats, well-wishers, and probably also some random people who got lost in JFK looking for where to pick up their Uber. Everybody, we brought Svetlana to America. We did it!
It is very difficult to explain in few words why I am here and why I have come. So I'm very tired.
I'm tired and I'm just the gay talking about it. But seriously, all of that? That whole journey from childhood, mother's suicide, Stalin's rule, family murdered, imprisoned, four marriages, two children, scattering ashes on the Ganges, secret defection, Delhi, Rome, I mean, not Rome, Switzerland, $1.5 million book deal, and now instant US celebrity. All of this, kiddos, this was all the boring part of the story. Because what happens next, that shit is cray cray. Svetlana Svetlana is a production of iHeart Podcasts and the Documentary Group. I'm your host, Dan Katroser. The show is written and produced by me, Adam Weber, Allison Joy, and Catherine Isaac. We also serve as executive producers. At the Documentary Group, our executive producer is Joe Bacilowitz, with production oversight by Stacey Klieger and additional support from Tom Yellen and Gabrielle Tenenbaum. Our iHeart team is supervising producer Casey Pegram and executive producer Maya Howard, editing assistance from producers Christina Loringer and Joey Pat. Original music by Ilan Isakov. Production counsel by Sloss, Eckhouse, Dasty, Haynes, Lawco. Clearance counsel by Ballard Spar. Fact-checking assistance by Megan Trout. Special thanks to my husband, Jordan Siegel, and Rosemary Sullivan, author of the book Stalin's Daughter. Excerpts from Svetlana Aluyeva's books, 20 Letters to a Friend and Only 1 Year, are provided by Chris Evans and performed by Cassie Greer.
My whole life, I've been told this one story about my family, about how my great-great-grandmother was killed by the mafia back in Sicily. I was never sure if it was true, so I decided to find out. And even though my Uncle Jimmy told me I'd only be making the vendetta worse, I'm going to Sicily anyway. Come to Italy with me to solve this 100-year-old murder mystery. Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
I am so excited about this podcast, The Bright Side. You guys are giving people a chance to shine a light on their lives, shine a light on a little advice that they want to share.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
iHeart Podcast Update, this week on your free iHeart Radio app. Fodor's Guide to Espionage, a 60s-era spy story of the world's first and greatest travel writer, Eugene Fodor, as he jet sets around the globe. Tongue Unbroken, Season 2. This podcast explores complex concepts of identity, resilience, erasure, and genocide. Table for Two, Season 2. Think of the show as a deconstructed Oscar party in podcast form. Each episode takes place over the romance of a meal and feels like you're seated next to a different guest at that dinner. Hear these podcasts and more on your free iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.